Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Malcolm X, the equal rights champion, rose to historic standing by blaming and shaming both white and black America, whites for oppressive racism, and blacks for putting up with it. Foil for the Christian preacher Martin Luther King, Malcolm was the firebrand who did not turn the other cheek, who mocked the singing of We Shall Overcome. At Malcolm's funeral 52 years ago, the actor Ossie Davis remembered his friend as a howling, shocking nuisance before his brave black gallantry took hold. Here was the scathing voice of Malcolm X in a famous speech, The Ballot or the Bullet, from 1964, a year before he was assassinated.
What is 20th? What do you call second-class citizenship? Why, that's colonization. Second-class citizenship is nothing but 20th century slavery. How are you going to tell me you're a second-class citizen? They don't have second-class citizenship in any other government on this earth. They just have slaves and people who are free. Well, this country is a hypocrite. They try and make you think they set you free by calling you a second-class citizen. No, you're nothing but a 20th century slave.
We are looking at Malcolm through a local lens this hour because he was a Boston story, more than many people knew. On arrival, he saw himself as a light-skinned black Lil Abner, a teenage hick from the countryside of Lansing, Michigan. He became, among other things, a shoeshine hustler and a soda jerk, then a housebreaker, then an obsessive reader and student in state prison in Massachusetts, where he joined Elijah Muhammad's Nation of Islam. Such was the rush of growth and contradiction. Malcolm Little becoming Malcolm X and a Muslim. It drives the new play on stage in Boston this month, Detroit Red, picking up the name that young Malcolm fancied after he came east. The playwright Will Power spent 2 years researching those Boston years.
You know, I've always been quite inspired by Malcolm X ever since I was a child. I grew up in the post-civil rights era of the 1970s in the Bay Area. And Malcolm X as a figure was very prominent in my community in the Fillmore. I didn't fully understand what he was saying exactly, but I kind of got the energy and the gist of it, you know? And so he was someone who was really applauded and looked to as a real beacon of light in our community in the 1970s. In fact, I went the first school I went to was the Malcolm X School. That was a Pan-African school that was called the Malcolm X School. You know, so we learned about all these historical figures, and then we learned about Malcolm X. So he's always been someone that's really been inspiring to me. And I've also, as long as I've, you know, back when I was a child, I've been very fascinated by this part of Malcolm's life because, you know, I growing up in, you know, many decades after this, and this is the 1980s, 1990s, there were young men that I knew that were kind of, you know, they were angry and they were brilliant and they were artistic and they were creative and they were sometimes violent. And they had this real complicated mix of pain and sadness and joy and anger. And when, like, I read the autobiography as a child, I was like, I know that person. I know these people. I know the Detroit Reds of my era, you know, even though this was decades later. Yeah. So I was really fascinated about how did this wayward teenager, not always criminal in that area, but definitely heavily into the criminality as time went on, searching for his identity like a lot of teenagers do, but really considered at the bottom of American society, how did he become this charismatic, fearless giant for African Americans and then for American cultures, this real icon? How did he become that when a lot of other dudes I knew around the way did not?
There's a public and a private story here. And yours strikes me as much more in the private, of a story of a boy, he's barely out of boyhood. His father's been murdered, assassinated. His mother is incapacitated. He's in a new city with his sister, and he's thrashing out in all sorts of directions. He's hustling, shining shoes, housebreaking, but there's also building there somewhere one of the great public men of the 20th century, a revolutionist,
right.
Really, an analyst, a tough-minded spokesman. And I found some of that still unexplained, where the public man was incubating.
Part of what I'm trying to do with this piece is kind of give you inklings of the brilliance of what's going to come. The foundations of that is still in him, even though he's this wayward teenager. You know, some of that he got clearly from his father. His father was a Baptist preacher who used to kind of travel around and preach locally to different churches on Sunday, but he also would gather small groups of people in, you know, rooms with shades pulled down, and they would talk about Marcus Garvey, which was incredibly dangerous to do in the Midwest in the 1920s and 1930s. So this idea of speaking truth, like he said that his father would never, like, bow his head when white people would walk by. You know, he would always, you know, stand tall as a human being. Things that we take for granted today. So clearly he got a lot of that from his father. And I think when he came back to, you know, the teachings of Elijah Muhammad and then his own, you know, philosophies towards the end, some of that idea of nationalism, you know, or kind of a global perspective had to come from his father. Also his mother, you know, those were some of the seeds in him. His mother read worldly news to him. They had these newspapers delivered from all over the world to this small town in the Midwest. And so they always tried to give him a global perspective on things, even though they lived in this tiny town. So I think those seeds were there. I also think being an African-American and also, again, all the different transformations that he went through, you know, he was able to learn all these different lessons. So part of his brilliance to me is not just his speaking ability, but Malcolm's ability to speak to so many different kinds of people. Now, I might have that to an extent. You might have that to an extent, to be able to speak to different kinds of people in different walks of life. The fascinating thing about Malcolm is not only did he have empathy and could reach different people, but he was actually at different points of his life, he had become those people. He was those people, you know?
Right.
So when he was talking to the guy who's hustling on the street, you know, this is years later, he used to be that person. He could speak to homeless people on the street, and he can debate someone at Oxford or Harvard and more than hold his own in a debate at Harvard University.
Well, there's a lot of Boston in the autobiography. How did you come to unearth the news, so to speak? And I want to hear the Will Power story here. What were you chasing for yourself?
I'm always, as a writer, drawn to stories about contemporary people or historical figures or whatever that hasn't really been thoroughly covered that much. People think of Malcolm X, they think of him and they associate him with a New York City Harlem figure. And he was, and there's good reason why he's associated with that. But he spent many years in Boston. Especially if you include the time that he was in prison, he spent 12 years in Boston, which was almost a third of his life, because he only lived 39 years. So he lived a lot of his life in Boston, influenced by Boston.
Who were the key teachers, influencers for him in that period?
Well, first and foremost, I would have to say his sister, Ella. She was the one that arranged for Malcolm to come, older sister, and she was more of a matriarchal figure, you know, and she was really a beacon in the Roxbury community. She was helping families come there for decades, her own family and other families that weren't her own bloodline. And also she hustled. She didn't hustle like Malcolm as far as like doing criminal stuff, but she was a real hustler, but she used that hustle to try to provide for her family, you know? I think his scathing critiques of white liberals, I think, you know, so not necessarily friends, but those experiences, my theory is that he had to have come across that in Boston, because in rural Michigan, there weren't necessarily white liberals in that way, you know?
Going back, I mean, can you picture that 18-year-old in Boston?
Yeah. No, I see him, you know? I see him working at the Parker Hotel. I see him, you know, walking, you know, to catch the train or what have you. I see him in Roxbury. I see him at the jewelry shop. I see him in the jazz clubs, you know. That's an exciting thought to me, you know. I mean, I do think that Malcolm's intellectualism. I mean, I don't know if I can prove it, but I think, you know, his intellectualism had to be partially from growing up during that time in Boston and just being around the people that he was around. My little limited time in Boston over these last couple of years, I found that, you know, people are very intellectual. I'm talking about poor people, middle class, wealthy, you know, white people, Latino, like people I talk to, people like engage in discourse. I would say that more than most cities that I've been to.
One last thing about just Boston, confronting Boston, getting to know Boston. He's remembered for saying that if you're south of the Canadian border, you're living in the South. What mm-hmm. did he see in Boston about racism itself?
It seemed to me that Malcolm experienced racism in the way that it manifests sometimes in the North. So in the North, it's very different than the South. It's maybe not necessarily Ku Klux Klan in that way, although there were some Ku Klux Klan in the North, but it's more like, you know, the bus riots of the 70s. It's like redlining. It's like how the government uses eminent domain. Like in the West Coast, a lot of times, you know, eminent domain was used. It was like we need to put a major street somewhere in San Francisco. So let's put it where the poor Black community is. You know what I mean? Like. And
right.
So it either was intentionally to disrupt the community or unintentionally.
There was a big Malcolm moment in the 90s, not to mention the 60s. What's the future of Malcolmism, Malcolm awareness, Malcolm modeling?
I would say the thing that's fascinating to me is internationally how Malcolm has been kind of adopted as a figure and as a beacon by a whole bunch of other cultures and countries. You know, we've gotten, I mean, this is a very Malcolm X story and a very Boston story, but we've gotten some calls from Chile. We got a call from a theater in Belgium that's interested in this piece. And I'm like, why Belgium? They're like, you know, a lot of the immigrants here in Belgium that are struggling, Malcolm is their hero. Malcolm is their figure. He's on t-shirts there. He's on posters in their rooms. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, the North African and Arab community is Malcolm. And then in Chile, they're like, well, we love Malcolm. We know Malcolm. So I think Malcolm is like global. You know, he's been global for a while, but I really feel like that's going to continue, particularly as this kind of right-wing kind of thing is kind of rearing its ugly head. There's a kind of look for, like, not just like, you know, faith and belief and strength today, but who are the ones that kind of did it back then of yesterday, you know, yesteryear. And I think Malcolm would have to be one of them.
Will Powell was known before Lin-Manuel Miranda and the show Hamilton as a prolific author of plays in verse, or hip-hop theater. He is teaching drama this winter at Spelman College in Atlanta. Coming up, styles of worship, schools of thought in Boston when Malcolm got here, among Marcus Garveyites, and remnants of Booker T. Washington's argument with W.E.B. Du Bois. This is Open Source. We're locating the Malcolm X saga geographically and also philosophically in Boston from the late 1940s. Brandon Terry is the Harvard humanist and historian who teaches a course on the autobiography of Malcolm X. Kerry Greenidge at Tufts has written two important books about the thought leadership in Boston, Black and white, around abolition and then race in the century after the Civil War. Get us started, please, Brandon Terry, on Malcolm's autobiography, as history, as narrative. I want to say, too, as literature. How did you discover it? How do you read it now?
Well, like a lot of people from my generation, we grew up in the midst of the 1990s Black nationalist revival. Leading the way were hip-hop groups like Public Enemy or X-Clan, people who put Malcolm at the forefront of their iconography. Obviously, Spike Lee's classic epic film, Malcolm X, came out in 1992. And amidst that ferment leading up into the Million Man March in 1995, there was just a huge interest, a kind of Malcolm mania I've seen it referred to in publications of the time. And the book made its way into my hands from my mother's library. And I read it in middle school and was just utterly transformed. I think for a lot of people who, you know, I grew up in Baltimore, And in a place where, as was revealed in the uprising not too long ago, a place where the differentials of wealth and opportunity are so starkly racialized. My colleague Raj Chetty, the economist, shows that the neighborhood in Baltimore that Freddie Gray is from, for example, has essentially the lowest social mobility in the entire country.
Wow.
Right? And you can move through the city and see opportunity partitioned by race. And when you grow up in an environment like that, if you're even remotely curious, remotely interested in striving yourself, you are searching for answers. And I think for a lot of us at that time, Malcolm provided a kind of answer. He seemed to give you an analysis of how deep-seated the problem of racism was and racial injustice, how this country had never quite faced it. It always evaded its responsibilities of justice. At every step of the way.
This is so fascinating, you know? But I got to say, I would think a lot of people in that scene would say, where's Malcolm? Where's some Malcolm to say the naked truth of this brittle, old, absolutely unjust, un-American scene? You know what I mean?
Right. Well, what he did for his generation and for every generation after was, when you live in a oppressive environment, when you live under injustice, you develop almost as a deep-seated habit all these ways of making the people who rule over you, the people who have power over you, comfortable. You learn to comport yourself in a certain way. You learn to speak in elliptical fashion.
Right.
And Malcolm just cut through all of that like a searing sword and said, this is the truth. I am full of righteous indignation, not just against white society, against white society, of course, but also against any black elite compromise with white society, right? It was a vicious black populist critique of the entire edifice and a pushing of all of us to try to think outside of the normal pathways of how justice might be achieved, because he thought that nothing that had been tried heretofore had ever worked.
Decode the word, the phrase black nationalism then, now. Is the ism important, or is it more that kind of common sense, face it?
Well, I think, and you know, Carrie can speak to this as well, but the longstanding tradition of black nationalism involves a couple of things, right? It involves the imagining of blacks as constituting a kind of people separate and apart in their destiny from the broader American polity. It involves imagining a kind of sovereignty, a kind of self-determination, a control over your politics, your economics, your culture, deep-seated demands of racial solidarity. So not just in politics, but in every avenue of your life. You marry black, you buy black, you listen black, you watch
black,
you vote black. So it's this swirl of ideas that in the 19th century was a lot about trying to establish an independent state, whether in Central America or Canada, Africa, even taking part of the southern United States and establishing a state. Once that became implausible, in part because of American empire, black nationalists had to go back to the drawing board, and they started to project all sorts of other kinds of alternative sovereignty. And the black nationalism that Malcolm espoused was a kind of transitional one. The dream of the independent nation state was failing. And what other ways could we establish a kind of independent power or authority to project, black power throughout the world and to protect black flourishing at home?
Carrie Green, to take it back to Malcolm in a sense, but also forward. But what did a black teenager from the sticks pick up about the life choices on offer in Boston, mid-20th century? There were arguments and there were schools of thought in the air. The most important, I'm now discovering, being Marcus Garvey.
Yes.
We know him for Back to Africa, which is a slogan and not a program. What should we know about that context in which Malcolm is sort of coming alive?
So Malcolm arrives in Boston in the early 1940s. At that point, Boston was 6 years past losing probably its most radical leader, whose name was William Monroe Trotter,
right,
who published The Guardian. And Trotter, by the end of his life, had absorbed all of these strands of black nationalist thought and radical thought, from socialism to communism to black nationalist thought. And Garvey, Trotter himself was an associate of Garvey's. And so by the time Malcolm X arrives in Boston, he's in a city and in a black community that is in transition. It's just experienced the Great Depression, but it's also right. still this incubator of the remnants of both Trotter in the 1930s and from 1901 to 1930s, and also Garveyism. So one of the things that Malcolm X would have encountered was the fact that Boston and Greater Boston had a large population of foreign-born, Caribbean-born members of the African diaspora mm-hmm. who were part of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which was Garvey's group, even if they themselves had never met Garvey because he comes to Boston. Garvey comes to Boston in the early 1920s. So there was definitely this fervor, this thought that was floating around Black Boston of a consciousness of being part of a transnational, global African diaspora, definitely of being part of something that was bigger than the small community in Boston at the time. Bostonians were only 3% of the population in 1940. But this notion that within that small community, there was this global sort of beating heart of black resistance. I would also say that when Malcolm came to Boston, he was coming at a time when the question of the old elite in Boston, who was actually leading Black Boston, was coming into question.
I want to know, how did you recognize a Garveyite? I mean, Pentecostal Black Christians know the difference when they meet evangelical Christians. How did a Garveyite know that you're a Booker T. Washington lady? And what was this sort of social effect of it?
So one of the main things is that when Malcolm X is living with his sister, Ella May Collins. He's living in an area of Roxbury that is a few blocks away from a predominantly West Indian church. And that church had been a center of Garveyism. So he's, even though he himself was not attending the church, he's in a neighborhood of people who that church was a center of black radical thought within the Caribbean and global black diaspora. He also would have, he talks a lot in the autobiography about the contrast between the Hill, African descended people in Boston who were middle right. or upper middle class, and then the rest of the people in Boston. So what he's referring to is this movement of black, upwardly mobile, middle class people to areas in Mission Hill, areas in areas of Roxbury that are middle class and upper middle class, and right. distancing themselves, Malcolm X would say.
He lived on the hill, but class. He scorned it at the same time.
Yeah, he scorned it at the same time, yes. And he's really in the midst of as that's happening. So he would have been arriving in the early 1940s when that was very noticeable in Boston. So the migration to the hill begins in the 1930s, and it's a way that the black middle class who could move are moving away from kind of the dread of the Depression. So he would have arrived right at the tail end of that, and that would have been very stark to him. So those two things, being around a community that was transnational in scope, that had kind of this Garvey black nationalist consciousness, was the first thing. And the second thing is being in a community where he's witnessing this transformation as he's arriving in real time. The fact that you have black people who can have a little bit of money, can move a little bit away from the black people in the rest other parts of Roxbury and Boston.
Brandon, get him out of prison into the 1950s. He's a Muslim by now, and he's an organizer. He's a militant in every aspect of his presentation. How did it become so scary in African-American world, but in white world too, obviously?
Well, I think you could actually track the exact date. In 1959, there's a documentary that Louis Lomax and Mike Wallace produce called The Hate That Hate Produced.
Yes, the Mike Wallace.
Right.
Yes.
This takes Malcolm X from being a kind of regional figure of minor note, a kind of if you know person, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously creating buzz around the country and Nation of Islam circles, but it blasts him into everyone's living room. And for America, both Black Americans, white Americans, to see, again, someone so forthrightly. I mean, they even perform the play, right? The famous Nation of Islam play, where they put white America on trial.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they played a prosecutor role. Louis Farrakhan plays the prosecutor role. But Malcolm took on that rhetoric. He's like a prosecutor. He says, I charge this society with just unbelievable depths of hypocrisy. The idea that you can call people citizens, right, while they have no rights, that you can call this a democracy, while people can be lynched and beaten and brutalized with total impunity, that you can profess to be a leader in the democratization and promotion of freedom all around the world and be involved in these most vicious forms of racial oppression abroad and at home. I mean, he was a prosecutor for the case of racial justice. And I think that was frightening to people because it's always frightening to people when someone appears as if they can't be compromised. They can't be bought off.
True.
That's terrifying to people.
Yeah.
But I just look back and wonder why the fright was the first and often case the last reaction. For example, after President Kennedy was assassinated. I mean, the worst thing, the most offensive thing he ever said ever was that this was chickens coming home to roost. People were just up in arms. How dare he say that? Today, more than 50 years later, we say, God, there's a truth in it. He had just not only been part of the assassination of President Diem in Vietnam, but there we were in a war that was just getting started at Kennedy's initiation in Vietnam. But we are so more aware now, sort of the inherent violence in our politics. Why did it all go into the scared reaction? We can't allow this sort of thing to be said on television anymore or something.
Well, I think there's two pieces to this. So one is a problem that's going to be at the heart of any Black nationalism, right? And when you have a philosophy that focuses so intensely on policing racial solidarity, one threat that's always going to be devil-lit is that you may partition your moral concern for others, right? You may lack the right kind of empathy, the right kind of connection, the right kind of appreciation for the moral claims of others, right? So I do think people recoiled in a way from a kind of callousness with which he treated the death of the American president, right, of John F. Kennedy. And I understand that. Like, there's a great moment in the autobiography.
I'm missing the callousness. And also I'm thinking of – apparently he said to his sister Ella, if they can do that to President Kennedy, what chance do I have?
Right, right.
Go ahead.
But I think there's a way in which that even when you're – and this is a great distinction with him and King, right? There's part of the loving your enemies point by King is to hold out hope that people are capable of transformation, that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. Mm-hmm. And so that even if you're relentless – and King was relentless about charging people with hypocrisy, with self-deception, with cruelty, with being commissioners of oppression. He says at the last instance, there is a kind of hope. And that holds back a level of cruelty that promotes a level of empathy that I think people noticed could be sometimes lacking in Malcolm's public pronouncements.
I would also add that part of what the comment regarding the Kennedy's assassination, it's made in the context, and this isn't to sort of excuse the brutality of the statement, but it's made in the context of what was happening with Patrice Lumumba and assassinations, right. American-backed assassinations of anti-colonial struggles throughout the world. And so part of, if we're to look and understand Malcolm X as being part of a Black radical tradition that's global and transnational in scope, one of the ways that things that he was referring to was the ways in which American empire was enacting the racial project that it had at home throughout the world, and that that was coming to the forefront by the early to mid-1960s, particularly at the height of the Cold War, when you have this rhetoric surrounding democracy and surrounding equality and surrounding the evils of the East versus the sanctification of the West.
Kerry, we all love the distinction between Martin and Malcolm. In what sense was Martin Luther King not a black nationalist, or in what way would that have been against the grain?
I always hesitate when I tell my students to say that they are pick them into like this dialectic of King versus Malcolm X. I would say that King was concerned ultimately, as Brandon is saying, with this Judeo-Christian ethic of sort of empathy and deliverance and the ability of people who have sinned in the way of racial injustice, of that coming to some sort of resolution. Malcolm X had a different view of that, but he's also kind of boxed into being, you know, his thought up until 1964, before he left the Nation of Islam. And he has this whole, you know, transformation in the last, you know, roughly 15 months of his life, in which he starts to look at the struggle and his rhetoric in a global context. And if he starts to do that, then he starts to argue, that, you know, perhaps what he said about white people, what does whiteness actually mean if in a global context?
In the peak of his Nation of Islam time, he's a tribalist in certain ways. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking nationalism is supposed to be back. Where's black nationalism today, in a word?
Well, I think it's the most fragmented and broken it's ever been in American history. And what you're seeing is the most interesting thing in black intellectual life is all of the pieces of black nationalism are moving into radically different streams of American life. In black feminist thought, black Marxist thought, white leftist thought. And we're in a real moment of recomposition, and it's an exciting time to think through the legacy of someone like Malcolm in light of it.
I want to hear where Malcolm would be coaching us if he were here today. Coming up, when he was born, said his sister Ella Collins, we expected great things of Malcolm. This is Open Source. We're tracking the vivid afterlife of Malcolm X, the iconic champion of freedom and human rights. He was a Bostonian from his mid-teens to late 20s, during the World War II years and after, and he is not forgotten in his old town. In the Frugal Bookstore on Warren Street, in the old heart of Roxbury, we fell into conversation this week with an inadvertent focus group of formerly incarcerated men, and then a woman in the store, all of them eager to speak about their Malcolm and how they found him. In order, they are the store owner, Leonard Egerton, then Charles Bogues, Glenn Williams, Chavella Lee Pacheco, and Azan Reed.
I read the autobiography when I was in prison the first time I came across it. It was like one of those books that was a must read that was being passed around to like the newcomers, the people that wanted to read. You know. When he was in that cell and he was reading, he wanted to learn the dictionary. That's what sticks with me most about him. You know, because I used to just start reading voraciously, just trying to learn the dictionary and doing push-ups to words and, you know, the cadence of the verb, the adjective, how the words are used. That's how he really affected me.
Yeah, my first introduction to Malcolm was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X while I was in prison. And what struck out to me was his belief in transformation. And the movie, you know, brought it more alive to me when I seen him when he was in the cell and he started reading the dictionary. And just trying to figure out, just going back over my own life, asking myself, how did I get to this state? And what struck me was, if you take the time, you get to learn yourself and you find your power within yourself that this doesn't have to be your life.
Glenn, first exposure.
My first exposure to Malcolm was when I was 16 years old. and I believe it was here in the Dudley area, and they had these displays of different historical figures. And I remember him looking sinister to me. I remember him looking scary to me. I thought that he was this mysterious, kind of threatening figure.
You say threatening, but he was also knowing. He was looking right through you, saying,
definitely.
I'm looking for you.
Definitely. Definitely. I read his autobiography, and I sobbed. And I remember just crying. It had that type of profound effect on me. And so for me, it was the first time that I came across a figure that made the type of mistakes that I made, that came from my type of experience, and proved that you could overcome criminality, that you can overcome poverty, that you could overcome the vices that defined your life.
I learned about Malcolm at a really young age. My sister's father was an African-American studies professor. And so Malcolm and Martin were just people that we heard about growing up all the time in the house. So I think I read his biography when I was 11. And it was around the same time that I was reading Asada's autobiography. So she more so took precedence at that time in my life. But there's a lot that comes out of Malcolm. And when you ask for quotes, I had to pull up my favorite one just to make sure that I read it verbatim. But a few things that I think are really important, especially in the time that we're in right now, is he said, if you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the people who are oppressed and loving the people who are doing the oppressing. And just in my education and growing up, I really learned how important education is. And thinking about Boston and who Malcolm X was in Boston and who Martin Luther King was and all these folks who came through our city, it really makes me look at the fact that we don't teach our students this. Our Boston Public Schools never talks about any of these icons, these right, historical figures who had roots in the city. When it comes to Black History Month, BPS never mentions Malcolm X because he's such a radical person. He empowered folks of color and had people of color who lived here understood that they had power. And in terms of the powers that be, people of color with power is dangerous.
What's the Boston piece of this whole story for you? He didn't love every aspect of it. He thought Boston Black people were kind of stuffy, pretentious.
Yeah, he probably thought they was a little stuck up in things. But, you know, for me, having him here was just super inspirational. Just the things he went through and different things like that in Boston. And just
he most certainly walked down Warren Street right past these windows.
Yeah, I remember reading things about, you know, him doing drugs out here and other people on drugs and things. And just, you know, him being able to come out of all that and educate himself in Boston. That's just super powerful. You know, he did it here.
There's actually a portrait of him there. I took a picture of myself there when I first got out of prison. Somebody told me it was there, but there's a lot of influence here. They've named an avenue after him. You know, I drive by the house every day on my way home.
Dale Street.
You know, on Dale Street, yeah. It's good to see that and to know that, you know, he was from here.
You grow where you're planted. And Malcolm committed his crimes on some of the same streets I did.
Really?
So to me, it's being able to rise above your circumstance.
Glenn, what's the your Boston piece here?
So for me, I grew up in Mattapan. And Mattapan, for a long time, was called Murderpan. Mm. So that's the type of environment I grew up in. Mm. I wasn't taught about the life of Dr. King, Malcolm X. I grew up looking for a sense of belonging. I grew up with this sense of disconnection. And finding out that Malcolm X and Dr. King had strong roots in Boston gave me a sense of inspiration.
Another important question. How many people here did some time at Norfolk, which figures largely in the autobiography? It's a very, very moving business, that schoolroom where I'm proud to say I taught for 6 or 7 semesters. You feel his charisma, his ghost, his challenge as you walk across that quadrangle. What about your own experiences of his own prison, Norfolk?
I spent my last 11 years at MCI Norfolk. And for a lot of us, Norfolk is like our institution of higher education. Mm. That's where individuals try to go when They want to go to school, where they want to be in environments where serious study right. is taking place, where the best programs are developed. I know for me, I worked in the prison library. I did programs, and I always felt the spirit of Malcolm. Mm. That's what inspired me. That's what kept me pressing ahead, knowing that this figure that a lot of us draw inspiration from walked the quad, studied in a library.
Amen.
So for me, it played a huge role in my development, in my transformation.
Like Glenn, I spent my last few years of incarceration in Norfolk. I worked in the library there for a few years. And you could feel his spirit in that library, you know, like the shelves, the books. You know he reached for the books. Mm. He was sitting in there studying. So sitting in there learning and just talking about him. Like you say, walking outside, imagining him, you know, being at the gong. They used to have a gong there that they would hit.
Mm.
When it was time to, like, make movements, you know, and then you'll see everyone walking around the quads, you know. So a lot of folk talked about Malcolm.
Kerry Greenidge, respond to some of these wonderful men. I'm struck this. It's so self-helpy. I wonder if Malcolm would say, guys, I got a program. We got to get busy. Mm-hmm. And glad you're back, but this is politics now. What do you think?
One of the things that strikes me about that is just beautiful. I was just thinking about how the power of literature, as we were saying before, the power of the words of somebody's life story to be written and to be read and to be absorbed by people in the place where that person was has this effect on somebody seeing something beyond themselves. So I wonder if Malcolm would have been not critical about sort of the self-help aspect that you're pointing to, but would have been inspired by the fact that a work of literature, a work of learning, a work of reading has the power to inspire people to see their lives and see their circumstances and just see the world very differently than what they've been told.
Thank you. I shouldn't be knocking self-help. To me, this book has always been a cousin of David Copperfield.
Yeah, yes.
A lonely boy, poor, undersupported, struggling, finding himself. And it's just, it's an incredible story.
Yes.
Brandon Terry, please.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think always has to be the message of Malcolm's autobiography is that we have this capacity for reinvention, right? Manning Marable underscored this in his biography of Malcolm X, that you can always transform yourself. And I think it's incumbent upon us as readers to note that Malcolm isn't telling a self-help story. He's very clear about the people along the way who help him make a transformation. He's very clear that without the kinds of structure and theology that the Nation of Islam provided him at a particular point, he wouldn't have made the transformation. That without the acts of solidarity, the experiences on his second trip to the Middle East, he wouldn't have made the humanist transformation that he makes toward at the end of his life. So it really is that thing for us. And for so many, I mean, listening to them reminded me so much of growing up, because I think every aspiring black radical at the time tried to read the whole dictionary.
Yes.
I tried that.
Aardvark first.
Yeah.
I did too.
I just want to say one more very Boston point about Malcolm. And it's not much in the autobiography or the Spike Lee movie. It's the family testimony that I find absorbing and powerful, and it's sharply at odds with, shall we say, the gangsta image of young Malcolm, that explosively angry teenager as in the play Detroit Red. Ella Collins, with a house on Wambeck Street, then on Dale Street in Roxbury, was Malcolm's older sister and the real reason he came to Boston from Michigan. Her version was that Malcolm was an anointed child, born to Great Expectations, Dickens again, and that more often than not, he towed the line that she laid down for him. Here is Sister Ella speaking with Sarah Ann Shaw in the late 1960s.
Malcolm was born the way he was. He was born, in fact, we waited for Malcolm's birth. We were of the superstitious tribe of Africa, the Watusis. And we believe that the seventh child came with certain, endowed with certain rights. that would surpass other children of that family. So when he was born, we expected great things of Malcolm. I felt that it was my duty to stimulate his arrogance, stimulate his impulsiveness, let him feel that life was the life that God gave him belonged to him. He didn't have to pay homage to anyone. This is how I guided him.
Ella Collins' son, Rodnell Collins, extends her point in a family history called Seventh Child, and again in conversation with me this week.
My mother made it incumbent upon him to study the history of European Americans and their struggle against the British. The thing that my mom would push is that look at what they had done to fight against the British. Travel around Boston, read, study, look at their struggle. And this is white tyranny. Study that history, that legacy. And it was a legacy of blood, sweat, and tears, not of hope, pray, and a dream. She wanted him to study that, and that's the struggle that, you know, you have to understand. Then that's what it's going to take here. It's blood, sweat, and tears. There was no time for idle trivialities.
That, to me, I must say, is the Boston story of Malcolm X. It's his big sister. He says in the autobiography, I didn't notice it until this time around, that they were the same type, and unlike most of their family, he said, we're dominant people.
Yes.
Bring it home, Brandon. Malcolm today, what would his testimony be in this incredible state of American culture politics?
Well, the young woman in the bookstore had an important quote, right? That if you're not careful, the newspapers will have you hating the oppressed and loving the people doing the oppressing. We live in a dark time, right? There's authoritarian creep all over the world. White racial terrorism is resurgent. Explicitly racist ideologies are resurgent and seeking new warrant in biological sciences. Malcolm would want us to be truth tellers, even at great cost, in the midst of all of these lies and prevarications. And I think he'd take that message globally. Remember his critique of civil rights needing to turn into human rights. So right. It's no surprise that his image is being taken up, his legacy is being taken up by alienated Muslim youth in the banlieues of Paris and places like that. He shows us about solidarity with the most oppressed, the people in prison, the people in the ghettos, the people in the banlieues, and that if we're not allowing their suffering to speak, we're never telling the truth.
Kerry Greenidge, as Brandon speaks, it's very powerful. I wonder, have we lost our opportunity to embrace Malcolm X?
I think we can always embrace Malcolm X. I think we can embrace, as Brandon was saying so beautifully, we can embrace the promise of being able to encourage, love, and nurture the worst of us, the most desperate of us, as a way, and that's the part of the steps in which we become sort of the most free by recognizing that if we lift up the worst and the most unredeemable of us, that those are that's the step towards true, you know, racial redemption.
Would he be getting a better reception today than he did in his prime? I mean, in American media, is our conversation ready for this kind of realism? You listen to the din around Donald Trump and the Democratic resistance or whatever it is, and you wonder, you're right, Brandon, it's truth-telling that's so scary and so difficult, but would it have as good a chance today as it did then even? Kerry?
I would say that the truth-telling, the media truth-teller at this moment. I think one of the brilliancy of Malcolm X was his ability to tell the truth not just on white America, but on sort of talk about class and regionalism and the ways in which oppressed people themselves can act on behalf of the oppressor. So I think that part of truth-telling is something that is sorely needed at this moment.
Brandon, last word. Where would we hear that truth today?
Well, one of the things that makes him such an enduring figure is that he paired the truth-telling with piety and sacrifice. So that part of our problem in this era is, I mean, in a way it goes beyond truth-telling to authenticity, right? That there's a way in which in this commodified, hyper-commodified culture, it seems that everything's for sale. Everything mm-hmm. can be bought off. That everybody, that even the people who are clamoring to positions of political power are really just there to market their next book or sell mm-hmm. their next wear. And to have someone like him who was so opposed to any of these self-aggrandizing things, I think that's a real message that can unsettle us in this moment.
Thank you, Brandon Terry and Kerry Greenidge. Thanks also to Rodnell Collins, Will Power, and our friends at the Frugal Bookstore in Dudley Square. They are Leonard Egerton, Charles Bogues, Glenn Williams, Chavela Lee Pacheco, Azan Reed, and the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of energetic, idea-driven podcasts. This week, try Mark Kreiler's Constant. Listen in at constantpodcast.com. Our show was produced by Connor Gillies, Adam Coleman, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our revolutionist. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.